The 1998 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 322, Drawing Lessons from Brigham's Purge of Dissidents, a discussion of Ron Walker's Wayward Saints, the Godbeites and Brigham Young. The panelists include Christine Pugmire Skidmore, Armin Moss, Catherine McKay. This is a 60-minute session recorded on a 90-minute tape, so the second half of Side 2 will be blank.
Who challenged Brigham Young's authority, and we will try to draw some parallels between dissidents in the church today. Our panelists are Armand Moss, who is a professor of sociology at Washington State University, who has published numerous prize-winning books and a number of articles. He's also a member of the Mormon History Association, the Society for the Scientific Study of Religion, and the Religious Research Association. In addition to his comments, our other panelists will be Catherine McKay, who is an associate professor of history at Weber State University. And we are really privileged to have the author here with us today, too. And hopefully at the end of the session, we will have time for comments or questions that we may direct towards him or the other panelists. We'll go ahead and get started first with comments by Mr. Moss.
Very few of the schismatic movements in the history of Mormonism have thrived to become either large or durable. The so-called new movement of the Godbeites was typical in that respect, but unique otherwise. I think it would have to be considered the most colorful of the post-Exodus schisms and the one most like a harbinger of the future. I had heard and read passing references to the Godbeites for years without having any idea how much there was to learn about them until Ron Walker's prodigiously researched study. This is a rich and thorough treatment of a very important episode in Mormon history. Beyond that general assessment, however, I will be commenting less on the work itself than on my own reactions to it, for such is the charge given me here, as I understand it. The tension between individual conscience and institutional imperatives is one of the oldest in human history, and has certainly been manifest often in Mormon history. This engaging story, therefore, is, as its author claims, a parable, not only for our own time, but for many other times as well. The excommunications several years ago of a number of outspoken LDS scholars were perhaps the most recent manifestations, at least publicly, of these typical and recurring tensions. And certain parallels suggest themselves to the Godbeite insurrection of the 1870s. Actually started in 69. One parallel between then and now can be found in the sense of crisis that seems to have existed in the minds of many church leaders as a context during both periods. In Godbe's time, the church had been besieged by military invasion and by a series of federal anti-polygamy initiatives. The brief respite from federal pressure during the Civil War had ended, and the railroad threatened to bring Gentile power and influence to a new high. It was no time for independent thinking, a new movement, or a liberal institute. More recently, after two generations of Mormon assimilation and Americanization, much of it during the cultural and moral upheavals of the 1960s and 70s, and the rise within Mormonism of all kinds of independent voices and publications, to say nothing of professional historians within the bosom of the church itself, some LDS leaders came to feel that the church was again under siege, this time from feminists, homosexuals, and so-called scholars. To be sure, the nature of the perceived siege was different in many respects as between the two time periods. And there were surely other differences as well, which I don't mean to gloss over. Yet both the 1870s and the 1980s can be considered decades of struggle over how much independence in thinking and in lifestyle can be tolerated within an essentially authoritarian institution, especially in times of crisis. During both periods, the struggle was resolved largely in favor of the institution, and not just because of the heavy-handedness of the leadership. At no time has there been much support at the grassroots either for assertions of individual independence. Mormon dissidents in modern times can be grateful, at least, that LDS leaders and members no longer possess the power, even if they were so inclined, to destroy a defector's livelihood or career, a common consequence during the days of 19th century theocracy. The worldly costs of dissent today, or even of excommunication, are different and generally much lower. The Godbeites and their new movement, furthermore, had a schismatic potential never achieved or even threatened, in my opinion, by today's intellectuals. In that respect, the Godbeites were unusual among history's schismatic movements. In Mormonism, as in most enduring religious traditions, schisms of the right are much more common and successful than schisms of the left. Now, by schisms of the right, I mean reactions to assimilation. By schisms of the left, I mean efforts to promote assimilation. With those definitions, I will repeat that in Mormonism, as in most enduring religious traditions, schisms of the right, or reactions to assimilation, are much more common and successful than schisms of the left, which, like the Godbeites, attempt to promote assimilation. The major Mormon schisms have actually occurred during the 20th century era of rapid assimilation. The polygamy schisms, the Order of Aaron, and more recently the True and Living Church in the Manti area. Even in the 19th century, though, the Morrisites would have been more typical schismatics than the Godbeites. I might just in passing note that in retrospect, perhaps the RLDS movement would have to be regarded as a schism of the left, that is, anti-assimilation, but its origins are complicated by the succession crisis of 1844, and thus I don't regard it as a schism in the way that I'm using that term here. One reason that schisms of the right are likely to be more common, that is, schisms of the right, again, those which react against the assimilation that the main body has been going through, a sense of secularization that the main body is throwing in the towel, giving in too much to the world, all of that. Reactions against that are what I call schisms of the right, again, so keep that in mind. One reason that schisms of the right are likely to be more common and more enduring than those of the left is that schisms of the right, like new conversions of all kinds, tend to involve people who share a basic and fairly rigid worldview, as well as many other fundamental values, which they regard as constituting the original religion from which the main body has drifted. Schisms of the left, by contrast, tend to attract people united mainly by a more varied and sometimes rather vague sense of disaffection from the institution. With the Godbeites, for example, the discontent of some of the dissidents focused mainly on economic matters. For others, it was theocratic power more generally. For yet others, it was mainly intellectual. And for still others, it was more personal. Interpersonal conflicts, character flaws, difficulties with polygamy, or some other personal agenda. With such a variety of agendas among dissidents, they are doomed almost from the beginning to a very fractious future. Another reality sapping the durability of schisms of the left, like Godbeites, is that the assimilation which they seek can always be easily achieved on the outside simply by moving individually into more mainstream religion or association, thereby reducing the incentives of individuals to sacrifice collectively for the new schism. It is not difficult to see why the new movement of the Godbeites did not endure, or why today's dissidents of the left have not formed themselves into a new schism. Indeed, such durability as the Godbeites did enjoy depended as much upon their support from the outside as from within their own ranks. The sociologist David Bromley has proposed a typological scale or continuum of religious exiters, people who exit. This continuum depends upon the kind and amount of outside support they receive as individuals or as schisms. The least public and disruptive form of the exeter is what Bromley calls defectors or leavers, people who just walk away. These are exeters who have simply lost their religious commitment and decided to walk away without acrimony and without requiring outside alliances or destinations of any particular kind. More public are those kinds of exeters which Bromley calls whistleblowers, who begin with a conscientious desire to correct some sort of serious flaw in the church or institution, and rather naively expect their admonitions to be heeded and appreciated by the institutional leadership. When instead they are ignored, silenced, or disciplined, then their future careers as whistleblowers, individually or collectively, will depend upon the kinds and amounts of outside support which they can obtain from oppositional groups like civil rights organizations, government agencies, or other religions. Without such support, their careers will not last long, and they will probably become excommunicants, or at least defectors, if they continue to give their dissent a high priority. Bromley reserves the term apostate for the third and most extreme case of the exeter who becomes suddenly or rapidly disaffected and acrimoniously severs ties with his religious community in order to punish or strive against that community from the outside. Again, however, in order to enjoy a career of any length as an apostate, he, she, or they must find support or membership in one or more oppositional settings, such as other religions or associations that are antagonistic to their erstwhile religious movement or institution, from antagonistic publishers, or from other antagonistic sponsorship that will support the apostates morally and financially as they devote themselves to the downfall of the community to which they once belonged. While any of these three types of exiters, that is, defectors, whistleblowers, or apostates, can occur in any religious organization, apostates will tend to be the more common type in those organizations or movements which are the least assimilated, those in the greatest tension with the surrounding society, because it's easier to get allies from the outside against such disreputable, quote-unquote, organizations. Defectors, or ordinary leavers, will be the most common type in the most highly assimilated religions. Throughout the history of Mormonism, I think we can see that the apostate type predominated in the 19th century when Mormonism was surrounded by outside antagonists. While the whistleblowers and defectors have become more common in recent years as Mormonism has become more assimilated. Among the Godbeites, the whistleblower and apostate types seem to have predominated, and with some of the apostates having begun perhaps as whistleblowers. Walker himself sees a similar continuum or spectrum in his final assessment of the careers of individual Godbeites, which he covers on pages 355 and 56. It's too bad that the Godbeites did not read Rodney Stark for some guidance about what criteria most conduce to an enduring new religious movement. For the Godbeites simply drifted into the ranks of unsuccessful new movements, which, as Stark reminds us, comprise the overwhelming majority of all the new movements of history. Stark has identified about a dozen criteria, the more of which a new movement possesses, the greater the likelihood of its enduring for two or more generations. The Godbeites fail on all but three or four of these important criteria. They fall short especially in the following respects in Stark's model. A, first, a leadership with adequate authority clearly legitimated in doctrinal justifications. You've got to have that Godbeites didn't have much of that. A highly motivated volunteer labor force willing to proselytize. A competitive religious context or economy, which Utah didn't provide much of in those days. Competition coming in that religious a competitive religious economy, competition coming mainly from weak local religious organizations. Another criterion, conversions largely from the ranks of the religiously inactive who have few ties holding them to competing groups. Next, the maintenance of a modicum of cultural tension with the outside environment through religious demands and on individual behavior, making demands on individual members, do this and not that. Intensive and consistent socialization of the young into the culture of the new movement. And finally, a high fertility rate that at least offsets mortality. And on all of those respects, I think I would argue that the Godbeites were weak. And it's not difficult then to understand against that model how they would have had trouble surviving. Another critical element of success, about which the Godbeite case provides mixed evidence, in my opinion, is the importance of key doctrines and promises that are unfalsifiable. That is, which cannot be empirically shown to be false in this world. The dabbling in spiritualism for some of the Godbeites is an interesting issue in this connection. Certainly, some of the leading Godbeites seem to have been satisfied that they had made contact with departed church leaders and others on more than one occasion. One wonders, however, if such attempts always worked or did so only part of the time. Certainly, for some who tried to make spirit contacts, it did not work. To the extent that continuing faith in the new movement depended on spiritualism, it presented a mixed bag. But it's not clear to me how important a part spiritualism played in the movement generally. Also, to the extent that the new movement promised greater worldly success for its members through mining or various kinds of commerce, the experiences of most Godbeites would not have validated their faith in those enterprises either, over the longer run at least. Finally, I found food for thought in Walker's periodic emphasis on the differences between British Mormonism and Utah Mormonism, even in this early period. For those who haven't read the book, observe in passing that the folks who associated with the Godbeite movement were disproportionately British converts and had known the British Mormonism before they came to Utah. I say there's food for thought then on the differences between British Mormonism and Utah Mormonism, even in this early 19th century. Apparently, Mormonism had a somewhat different appeal to each constituency. As Marvin Hill has argued, the early American converts to Mormonism were drawn in large part by the refuge Mormonism promised from the rampant and confusing American pluralism and individualism around them. Walker suggests that the British converts, by contrast, were fleeing from a rather rigidly stratified and conformist traditional culture of England to a Mormonism seeming to offer more of the American individualism, politically, intellectually, and spiritually. If this is so, then Mormon recruits or converts from the two countries were seeking somewhat different religious destinations and were bound at times to come into conflict. One might add here the example again of the Morrisites, who were made up disproportionately of Scandinavian converts, disappointed by the failed attempts in mainstream Mormonism to make good on the promises of a communitarian or at least socialistic way of life. If such clashes of cultural background could occur in the 19th century among convert groups as basically similar as American, British, and Scandinavian, can the Mormonism of the 21st century accommodate in a single religious way of life the many exotic cultural backgrounds now being brought into the church? That, of course, is a different issue calling for a much longer discussion. Thank you.
I'm really sorry about this. Well, let me at least take the mic here so that we can have a discussion, and let me make some comments, and then we'll start this discussion. Dr. Walker argues that the Godbeite revolt is significant in terms of the making of modern Mormonism, that it is part of an era in which the reaction to the Godbeite movement and the merchant wars and the coming of the Transcontinental Railroad and other influences, the assault by the federal government, that the corporate church, Brigham Young personified, began to structure things in different ways, a reaction that becomes part of modern Mormonism. Starting the Sunday School, renewing the Relief Society, perhaps today's parallel is correlation, organizing the School of the Prophets, a place where issues could be discussed, boycotting Gentile merchants, and organizing ZCMI. Again, the corporate structure of today's LDS Church might be parallel. In terms of theological questions, the Godbeite movement doesn't seem to have very much effect. Even though the questions about personal conscience related to...
Would like to open this discussion up. Is it on? Okay. Would like to open up the discussion now to comments or questions. It struck me as listening, while I was listening to these two panelists that were speaking prior to this, that the critical issue here, according to how I feel about this, is that the independence of thinking and lifestyle, how much can be tolerated, I believe, is how Dr. Moss stated that. I think that's the key issue here, because that was a critical question back then as well as now. And maybe we can draw some lessons from the history of what happened in the past and compare that to what's going on now with people whose cultural differences or their philosophical differences are somewhat different. If you have questions, would you please come down and maybe sit at the front row and use the mic to ask your questions. And Dr. Walker will give him the mic, or please feel free to ask questions of the other panelists also. The time is now yours. Come on down if you have something to ask. Okay, what was the size or scope of the purging, and how was this accomplished? Are you directing that to Dr. Walker? Okay. He's right here. We might as well have him here.
Is the mic working? I can't hear here. Can you hear me? What you don't understand is my fatal ability to destroy anything technical. And that is a far-reaching phenomenon in my life, and even my presence in the room will do it. It's just inevitable. I did not come to make a presentation. In fact, you know, usually when you have a session such as this, you sort of think in your own mind what you might say. Well, I'm working on another book right now, and I'm really thinking about what I'm going to say about that. So when I came down this morning, it's really a tabula rasa. It's a sort of a blank slate. But I'm very pleased to respond to any of your questions, and I'll see if I can get re-immersed into the Godbeite book. I think the question was how many were involved, and how did the church attempt to suppress. It's very difficult to give a quantitative aspect to the movement, because I think as it broke out, there was a tremendous, well, I'm not sure tremendous is the right word, but there was an inclination on the part of many Utahns to embrace some kind of reform in the territory. The the policies of President Young as the railroad approached were quite severe. And correspondingly, there was, I think, a desire on the part of many Utahns to see some kind of reform or modification. So I think we could hypothesize that there might have been a very extensive sympathy. But the problem is the Godbeites announced fairly quickly a program of radical theology which alienates, which perhaps minimizes what could have been. I think they were anxious to bring a reform. I think they were aggressive in throwing down the gauntlet. And you get the impression that as President Young goes into this era, this period, very aggressive himself, he counters and he quickly retreats in the face of the of this possible revolt within the ranks. I get the impression in reading the sources that President Young actually is trying to minimize and avoid the confrontation. It is put upon him. And when it is put upon him, in contrast to the procedures of the past several years, he suggests an open trial. So so Godbee and Harrison themselves are tried at the city council building in front of the local ecclesiastical leaders of the church. It's an all-day proceeding. I think it is with reluctance that President Young proceeds against several of the Godbeites who were, whom I think he saw as extremely promising. I don't think he wanted to lose some of them. Other comments or questions? Yes. Was there either explicitly or implicitly violence threatened against them? I think the Godbeites thought so. There is a period of time when they're huddling in their homes and in their stores thinking that the destroying angels are about to descend upon them. It's hard to really evaluate that. I think President Young was far too wise to have tried to have suppressed them violently. This was a national issue. And what was going on was being carried extensively in the national press. The leading newspapers of the country had reporters on scene. It would have been an absolute disaster for any kind of suppression, whatever President Young's personal inclination might have been. So I do not see any violence in the suppression. I think President Young's policy throughout the entire episode, after the trials were concluded, was to try and defeat them with silence, ignore them. And this was very frustrating to the very intellectually agile Godbeites. They wanted to debate, and President Young wanted to ignore them. Yes. The question is, as I wrote the book, was I consciously aware of the perils of our time? Yes. I think if you read the book carefully, you will see, as in all works of serious writing, great personal and autobiographical feeling. But I tried to restrain that. I tried to restrain that, and I tried to allow, I wrote it as Armin suggested, as a parable. Parables are not successful if you provide explicit answers. And it seems to me that the best thing I could do was to present in all its rich, exciting, dramatic color the questions of the controversy. And it seems to me that the power of, hopefully the power of the book is found in its ability to stir and ask questions, which you have to respond to. I wrote the book in a very different way than most history books are written. Yes. God Beyond case, it seemed to occur with greater certainty the further you lived outside of Salt Lake City. Maybe concentric circles, the further, the most outreaching outlined circle, this kind of tribalism and expulsion from the family, this expulsion from the community, was very pronounced. Now, I don't know how to comment other than that, to say that that's probably inevitable in any kind of proceeding, and it certainly was inevitable in the close-knit family village society of rural Utah, rural non-Salt Lake City, Utah. It certainly happened, yeah. Well, I think every group, coherent society has their own means of doing that, and obviously nothing that extreme occurred during this God Beyond thing, but in degrees, certainly it did. Before I take another question, might I just say that I wrote this book on about three or four different levels. And I think as you read it carefully, you will see that there's different levels of narrative and interpretation and analysis. It's meant to be a collective biography. It's meant to be a whopping good narrative story because I think it's full of all kinds of color and personality. It's meant to be analysis. It's meant to be intellectual history. But inevitably, there were other dimensions that I did not include that I wish I had heard these wonderful commentators, and especially Armin's sociological analysis. There would have been yet another layer had I done so. I am very grateful for the comments, which I think are very appropriate and very on target. There are two people in a line here. Let's take the furthest one back. Yes, that's you. Yes. Three or four questions there, and I'm inevitably going to forget some of them, but help me out. One question was, to what degree was this economic? What degree was it theological? William S. Godbey was one of the leading merchants in Salt Lake City. He had been a mentor of President Young. He was a successful businessman. And certainly he did not feel comfortable as President Young moved to solidify Utah society in the face of the coming of the railroad and the Gentiles. This is the time that we have ZCMI. This is the time that President Young is trying to maintain this cooperative society of Zion. So clearly, Godbey is restive when President Young is talking about his balance sheet and his profit margins. That's how the movement has traditionally been interpreted. It's been interpreted primarily as an economic reaction. Catherine chides me a bit for saying that it was more than that and that it was a theological dispute as well. You'll have to read the book and be your own judge of that. But it seems to me that Godbey and Harrison, particularly, Harrison was a brilliant intellectual, were very restive with traditional Mormon teaching. And I think they concealed, to some degree, their alienation from Mormon theology. And their concealment has not really been placed in the historical record. My book tries to suggest that they were far more than economic radicals, that they were theological radicals as well, to the point of abandoning such basic Mormon teachings as the efficacy of the canon or even the Christian atonement. So I think they completely move beyond traditional society, traditional theology, Mormon theology. Now, there is another question which makes this whole thing so impossibly delicious and complex, and that is the issues of orthodoxy in 1870 economically were very different than issues of orthodoxy today. President Young was trying to maintain a closed society. An egalitarian society. I think traditional Mormonism has moved quite beyond that to a pluralistic economic interpretation. So it really, things have shifted. And I think that gives some salt and seasoning to my narrative. Yes. I think Armin might be better at this than I, with his sociological perceptions.
I am not a true prophet. I expect to see more schisms of the true and living church kind down in Manta. As Mormonism, I think, continues to strive for general Christian respectability, we will have more and more folks who think that's the wrong way to go and will either follow the Manti schism that's already in existence, which I gather is also having a hard time, or will begin new ones. I don't expect any of these schisms to last. I just think that they will occur because right now, although the so-called intellectuals get all of the press coverage as defectors, dissidents, and the like, let's face it, we are an infinitesimal minority posing no threat to mainstream Mormonism in any way, shape, or form. And also, we're all a fractious bunch. We'll never be able to get together on any particular kind of other direction. So I don't expect much schism in that, the schism of the left, as I said. I expect more schisms of the right. But I'll add one thing. I think the real interesting arena for future schisms is going to be outside North America. I think that's where you want to watch for schisms. And some of them will, I think, be more parallel to the Godbeite movement in many ways than the others that I mentioned that are here in North America.
It is the second point that I would echo, and again, I think that's one of the strengths of this text, is his provocative suggestion that it was this group that had an outside experience that came to be part of Zion, but they brought all of that experience, those ideas, those associations with them, and they kept not quite fitting into the Utah Zion or Brigham Young Zion. And I think that there's a lot of that, and that will only continue. By the way, while I have the mic, I also want to acknowledge one other strength of the book in terms of the humanizing of the Godbeites, which I think is really at the core of this, And that is this discussion of friendship and how much friendship matters in these various associations. And in many ways, some of the schism is a schism of friendship. And that's the hardest. That's the most traumatic schisms of all. The friendship between Godby and Young, the friendship between Godby and Harrison, and the friendships, I think, are one of the very vital and important contributions Dr. Walker has made to this discussion.
Let me just comment on that, and it goes back to an earlier comment about tribalism and expulsion from families. Shortly after Godby's trial, he writes this very plaintive letter to President Young. It's just an incredible letter in which he pleads for understanding, sympathy, invokes their friendship. President Young, as near as I can tell, never answers the letter. And yet on other occasions, President Young will say repeatedly, there was never a time in my life that I did not love William Godby. But that never allowed him to extend a hand after he left. Dissent, I think the dissent is going to fall internationally. That would be my quick answer. Yes. When they announce their movement, they suggest that they are orthodox in terms of polygamy. But that quickly changes. These are au-courant intellectuals. And they quickly realize that plural marriage has no place in their world. And that poses a great dilemma, because Godby has four wives. And what does a conscientious, decent man like Godby do vis-a-vis the women that dearly love him? And fortunately, there are some surviving letters that suggest the tension in Godby's life and in the life of his wives as they are set aside. As the women are set aside. I think that's some of the most poignant parts of the story. Yes. Yeah, I have no idea. It's an 11 o'clock session? Yes, okay. I'm not sure I understand the first, so try me one more time. The first question is, was there a ready avenue for a rank-and-file member to register dissent prior to the... I think not. To your second question, did the Godbyite movement have an effect? I think it did. I think President Young clearly understood the need for moderation, and I think you see a different shift in his administration after 1870, and I think with the next coming generation of church leaders, I think it did make a difference. Thank you very much. I'm honored to have been here.
Thank you so much to our panelists and to Dr. Walker, and I might add that his book is for sale at the Sunstone Mercantile at a 10% discount, and he'll be available to autograph those at noon. Thanks.